You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The question for me is then, well, how do we explain these things? Is it simply a passing but self-correcting phenomenon, this case of what someone has described in the context of Latin America as Canadian gringos? Is it a self-correcting phenomena? Is it a question of mistaken policy choices by a renegade Tory government, even though the Liberals have been doing the same thing, even if the Tories are in some ways more open and blunt and perhaps longer-term thinking about it, in my opinion anyways? I want to suggest to you that it's not a passing or a self-correcting phenomenon, that it's not simply a case of bad policy choices, and that however much legislation such as that which failed in the fall to place some restrictions on the practices of Canadian mining companies in the third world, put forward by a Liberal backbencher, John McKay, and which failed, of course, because the Tories opposed it, as did a number of Liberals and four NDPers who didn't show up, as well as four or five bloc members didn't show up for the vote. However important such legislation is, even though that piece of legislation was really quite tepid, I want to suggest that what we're talking about here is actually much deeper. Right? It's, in fact, a structural issue that's going on here, and it is rooted in Canadian capitalism, and it's rooted in capitalism more broadly. The logic of capital is an expansionary logic whereby companies must expand abroad with the support facilitated by their states to seek out new markets and new areas to increase their profitability. This is a rooted in the history of capitalism. It's not a new thing, obviously, but if we don't identify that as an issue, then we're going to miss a lot of what's going on in the context of Canada. So the issues that we're talking about here, these human rights violations and the ecological devastation, are systemic to Canadian capitalism, and they will continue to be a part of what's going on and to define Canada's relationship with the third world. And it's going to be up to movements in the third world and movements here in solidarity with those movements that ultimately will challenge what Canadian companies with the support of the Canadian state are doing. It's not something Canadian companies are just going to change on their own, because that's not what drives capitalism. And it's certainly not something that the Canadian state is going to, of its own volition, choose to change. So in order to understand these various things that I've highlighted, Canada's response to the coup in Ecuador, its cozying up to unsavory regimes in Colombia or Honduras, or in order to understand Canada's support for ongoing support for structural adjustment policies or the resistance Canadian companies face for their practices in the third world, to understand these things properly, fully, I think that we need to understand the growth of Canadian capitalism in the third world, and that's fairly central. And so what I want to do is just highlight a few points, somewhat abstract, a little bit of data for people, and hopefully I won't bore you with it, but just to give you a sense of how extensive it actually is, because I think often people don't realize how extensive it is. And of course, Canadian expansion and the expansion of Canadian companies into the third world is not a new thing necessarily. It goes back to the 19th century, particularly with banking and like Royal Bank in Scotia built themselves up in large part through their practices of following, at the time, American-backed dictatorships throughout the Caribbean, Central and South America, and, of course, Canadian mining companies, such as INCO, which is no longer a Canadian mining company, but had a history in Guatemala, for example. Activists against INCO were assassinated during the heydays of the dictatorships in Guatemala. So it's not a new thing. But the last 25 years or so, the period of neoliberal globalization, neoliberal global capitalism, has seen, I think, an unprecedented expansion of Canadian capitalism, of Canadian corporations into the third world. Of course, Canada's not alone here in this phenomenon over the last 25 years. You've seen an expansion of companies from the global north in general expanding into the south. But the trend has been particularly salient for Canada. And this, of course, I'm not going to go into detail about it here, but it follows the debt crisis of the third world in the early 1980s, and the IMF and the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, coming in and forcefully prying open and liberalizing the markets of third world, heavily indebted third world countries as a condition for getting bailouts and loans and so on. And that's the context in which you see this expansion of Canadian companies, of global north companies in general, but Canada in particular. And Canada's actually been a leader here to some degree. So just to give you a few highlights of it. Well, the first thing to note is that for the last 10 or so years, Canada's actually just in general, not even measuring for the size of its economy, because Canada's economy is smaller than other G7, G8 country economies. Measuring without just in terms of absolute numbers, Canada is consistently now one of the largest foreign investors in the world. And foreign investment is important, just sort of backtrack for a moment, because foreign direct investment is, as David McNally points out and other people have pointed out, David Harvey and so on, has been a sort of a key feature of the period of neoliberal globalization. It's actually grown at very extensive rates since the early 1990s. And foreign direct investment represents, well, it's foreign investment, so it's from one country into another. And direct usually refers to 10% or more ownership of an equity that's being invested in, whether it's a mine or a privatized utility or a bank or a plot of land for agribusiness and so on. And that usually confers on the investor, upon the investor, some degree of managerial control. It's the case, however, that in the majority of foreign direct investment that goes on, say, by Canadian companies, that is much, much greater than 10%. And so people have pointed out, observers have pointed out, that today foreign investment is the key sort of economic dynamic, or a key economic dynamic of globalization, not free trade. This is what we should really be focusing on in many respects. And it is a way in which countries of the global north and companies of the global north have managed to gain access to and control over the labor and the resources and the wealth of countries of the global south. Ellen Wood, for example, in her research talks about this sort of shift from political imperialism of territorial conquest to today's more market-based, economic-based form of imperialism. Canada is one of the largest foreign investors in general in the world now, and you can look at the data through the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, its annual world investment reports. Canada is consistently in the top 10 to top 15 foreign investors in the world. Increasingly, Canadian foreign investment is going to the third world, and that's important to note here, obviously. So in the 1950s, and for most of the post-war period, Canadian foreign investment into the third world as a percentage of total Canadian foreign investment stood at around 10% or so. It begins to shift in the early 1990s to the point where by 2007, Canadian foreign investment into the third world as relative to total foreign investment was over 27%. So a significant growth from 10 consistently thereabouts in the post-war period to, by 2007, over 27%. If you control for the size of the economy, that is, people usually talk about controlling for the size of the economy, they'll look at the amount of investment relative to gross domestic product. That's one way of controlling for the size of the economy, and you can do comparisons with other countries. And so Canadian foreign investment into the third world relative to the size of the Canadian economy, its gross domestic product, really takes off again in the 1990s through into the 2000s. And so by 2005, Canada had actually had the second highest orientation of investment to the third world relative to the size of its economy amongst G7 countries, only behind at that point the United Kingdom. I haven't looked in the last couple of years to see where it's at, but Canada was clearly had one of the highest orientations to third world investment amongst the G7 countries. When I was doing the research, the data wasn't available for Russia. But it's not just the amounts or the orientation going to the third world, it's also the profitability, the profits that are being earned by Canadian investment into the third world. And again, if you compare it to the profits earned off Canadian investment in general, you see a significant increase. So in the 1970s, Canadian profit into the third world as a proportion of total Canadian profit from its foreign investment stood at around 25%. It was just under 25% in the 1970s. By 2000 to 2007, it was over 45%, just to give you a sense of how much that increased. And so that rate of increase is, in fact, higher than the rate of increase of Canadian investment to the third world. So what you're seeing is an increased investment to the third world, but an even higher increase in the amount of profits that are being earned by Canadian companies in the third world. And so if you look just in terms of the raw numbers, profits from all Canadian investment into the third world increased in 1980 from $3.7 billion to $23.6 billion in 2007, a 535% increase. And that rate of increase is actually higher than the rate of increase of profits earned by Canadian companies at home. Okay. So I'm throwing out a lot of data for you, and there's no test at the end, so no worries. You're not being asked to memorize any of that. I'm just trying to do, in admittedly in an abstract way, because we're just talking about numbers, and there's human beings behind these numbers. We should never lose sight of the fact that there's social relations behind these numbers. But the point that I'm making, just in short, is that Canadian capitalism has a very significant orientation to the third world, right? And it's not smaller than that of other major powers. It's a significant, and in many cases more significant than that of other major global capitalist countries. The third world is an increasingly important place for Canadian companies to do business and to earn profits. And of course, such the title tonight is Open Pit Imperialism, and of course that this presence of Canadian companies has been most notable and most controversial in mining. Mining has gotten a lot of attention, largely because of the important work that activists, some of whom are in this room and other parts of the country, have done to trying to bring to light what Canadian mining companies are doing abroad and organizing in solidarity with those communities. Very important work. And so for that reason, I think there's a little bit more familiarity with Canadian mining and the role that it has in the third world. And Canada, of course, as was said earlier, has the largest mining industry in the world. But it's also just worth noting that Canada has a significant presence and significant and leading companies in a whole range of industries. So mining, in one respect, it's a very imperfect analogy. Mining, in one respect, is kind of like the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more that's going on, right? Mining, I guess, but what I mean by that is slightly more visible. But beyond that visibility of mining is a whole range of other industries in which Canadian companies are active and exploiting the cheap, vulnerable labor of the third world and the resources of the third world, and systematically drawing the wealth of the labor and the ecology of the third world back to Canada for the benefit of those Canadian companies. So, for example, sweatshop manufacturing. Canada has one of the largest T-shirt and sock manufacturers, Maquila Manufacturers in the world, Guild and Activewear of Montreal. Canada has a number of leading oil and gas companies that are active throughout the third world, whether it's Talisman, who used to be active in Sudan, is now active in Colombia, or in Canada, that was active in Ecuador before indigenous activists repeatedly shut it down. It was forced to basically gave up on the country at the time. To, I mentioned banking, of course, insurance companies. Canada is also a leader in engineering and dam building. Fortis from Newfoundland, or SNC-Lavalin, an engineering company that plays a key role in contributing to dam building. But also, it's important to mention, this isn't so much an issue of foreign direct investment, but it's important to mention that Canada has been consistently, for at least the last 10 to 15 years, one of the largest weapons exporting countries in the world. And there's people have done some very important research on that through Project Plowshares and others, who are sort of as best as they can, because the information is not as systematic as it should be from the Canadian government, not surprisingly, but have been documenting the extent to which Canada is involved in weapons manufacturing, including the companies against Canadian policy that are engaged in systemic human rights violations against their own populations or populations that they're illegally occupying, so to Israel, for example, or to Colombia, or to Musharraf's Pakistan. And so, of course, what's at stake here goes without saying for local communities in the third world is extremely significant, because wherever Canadian companies go, human rights abuses and environmental disaster follow. Again, it's not anomalous, right? Whether it's in sweatshop manufacturing or mining or dam building and so on, human rights abuses follow. Of course, we know that for a mine to proceed, as was discussed earlier, for mines to proceed, or for dams to proceed, or for oil and gas developments to proceed, communities who live above those resources have to be displaced, often very forcibly displaced, whether it's by paramilitaries who are connected to the Colombian military, who are in the pay of local company, of foreign companies, or security firms, and so on. These folks have to be forcibly displaced often. Or if communities are living adjacent to mining companies, they don't necessarily have to be forcibly displaced, but they're campesino communities or indigenous communities trying to eke out a subsistence livelihood, then often these kinds of developments, these kinds of major natural resource development projects, will destroy much of that basis for a subsistence livelihood, because opening up a mine requires, as was said earlier, significant infrastructural development for it to function. You need to build access roads. You need to power the mine, which means building hydroelectric dams, for example. So there's a whole process that's involved in this that really puts a great deal of pressure on local communities. And so what we know, and what I think probably a lot of people are familiar with, is communities that tend to resist tend to face a lot of repression for doing so, and a lot of pressure for doing so. I talked about the assassinations, Colombia, in which Canada is a significant foreign investor and has become an important ally of, leads the world in trade unionists being assassinated. It accounts for about two-thirds of the trade unionists that are assassinated every year in the world. But it also, there is every year a significant number of indigenous people who are assassinated in Colombia for resisting foreign investment, or who are displaced, or who are threatened. And studies have shown that the majority of those assassinations and that displacement takes place in areas that are key to mining in Colombia. It's the mining areas where most of that is taking place. And again, Canada, not the only foreign investor in mining in Colombia, but it is a major one. So there's a direct link right there in that particular a case. And so we could give other examples of this, of course. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, just in case anyone was wondering, not the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, but the Food and Agricultural Organization, has done studies looking at poverty in Latin America and arguing or demonstrating that areas that have some of the highest rates of poverty are often areas that have been subjected to major natural resource development projects. Because as was said earlier, most of this doesn't lead to jobs, significant increase in jobs, but it does lead to displacement. So if anyone tells you, well, Canadian investment is increasing jobs and prosperity for people, it's increasing prosperity for some people, the leaders of these companies and their major shareholders. But for people on the ground, for the most part, no, that's not the case. And so I want to just turn our attention now to some examples of the way in which the Canadian state supports this, and I think it's worth just highlighting these quickly. And I say the state purposely rather than just the government, because I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that the Canadian state, of course, includes the government, but it's not just the government of the day. The Canadian state is the apparatuses or institutions of power in Canada, which include things like foreign affairs and international trade, the Canadian International Development Agency, CETA, which is Canada's official aid body, or Department of National Defense, or Finance Canada, and so on. So these things together, including government, I'm referring to when I talk about the Canadian state. And the Canadian state and sort of the policymakers in the Canadian state are not ignorant of this dialectic of capitalist expansion and resistance that I've just described for you. This expansion of Canadian economic interests globally, and the human rights abuses and the ecological abuses that follow, are all made possible by the Canadian state. Right? These aren't rogue practices that the Canadian state would like to stop. Right? It's not like they want to talk sense into Canadian companies. They might want to provide a nice veneer for them to try and suggest that they're not as bad as some of us might think that they are, but they don't want to stop it. That's not what the Canadian state is about. The Canadian state promotes it. It facilitates it. And I would argue that the highest level officials in the agencies that I've just named, including as well officials in Canadian embassies throughout much of the third world, are very clear on what their role is. And their role is to facilitate the expansion of Canadian companies, which is really, in fact, the role of a capitalist state. Right? The Canadian state is a capitalist state. Just because it's Canadian doesn't mean that it's more benevolent or benign than other states. I obviously don't subscribe to the left nationalist thesis of Canada. So I'll just quickly highlight, very quickly, some of the a few good examples of how Canada supports Canadian companies abroad and the expansion of Canadian capitalism. One, of course, which was, has been mentioned, is structural adjustment policy. It started doing that in the 1980s under Marcel Massé. It continues to do that. It's worth noting that this is a policy that's important to the Canadian International Development Agency, to CETA, as a condition for getting Canadian aid. You see it in reports from the Department of Finance, where it talks about the importance in terms of its relationship to the IMF of structural adjustment. Now, they don't call it structural adjustment anymore. They've changed the name because that's been sullied because of the misery it's caused throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s and the resistance that it faced and the so-called IMF riots that took place. So what they did was change the name. And so they call it now things like Poverty Reduction Growth Facility, which is a nice sounding, you know, because, you know, we're all for poverty reduction, of course. Or they call it the Poverty Reduction Strategy Papers process. And basically, just what that is quickly, is it again another way of providing a sort of veneer for structural adjustment by basically saying to local governments that you can now, if you want to, with the support of civil society and so on, you can develop your own structural adjustment policy. Then you'll propose it to your donor countries and the IMF, and then they'll okay it or not okay it and so on. But it's up to you to sort of come up with it. And so that's another example. Another good example of Canadian state support, of course, would be foreign free trade agreements, which in fact really aren't actually so much about free trade as they are about investment rights and investor rights. And subsequent to NAFTA in 1994, Chapter 11 clause, which is a sort of, at the time, was a cutting-edge foreign investment clause for foreign companies, all Canadian trade agreements have been based on NAFTA and trying to build on NAFTA. Canada also has bilateral investment treaties that basically are just Chapter 11 taken from NAFTA. And it has Canada has trade agreements with 13 different countries, the majority of which, not all, but the majority of which are in the third world, and it has two dozen bilateral investment treaties, again, the majority of which are in the third world. And it's also worth noting that in terms of investment relations, it's extremely one-sided, because most of the investment actually goes from Canada into the third world, very little coming from most of the countries that Canada has trade agreements or investment agreements coming into Canada. I mentioned CETA, and I just want to draw out a couple more points about CETA. I mentioned them with respect to structural adjustment policy. But there's other ways in which CETA, which is supposed to be about, you know, it presents itself as this humanitarian, benevolent organization. But on top of supporting structural adjustment policy as a condition for getting Canadian aid, CETA is also, I'm sure some people who are active around mining are aware, has actually funded the rewriting of mining codes in a number of different countries, most notably in Peru with the so-called Mineral Resources Reform Project. And it's worth noting, they never call it, we're rewriting mining codes for our foreign companies and neoliberalism. So they call it things like Reform Project. They spent $9.6 million in Peru on that. Canada also played an important role in financing the rewriting of the Colombian Mining Code, which is one of the cutting neoliberal mining codes in terms of liberalizing property relations, land, and indigenous land in particular, and providing access for foreign companies. CETA also funded a poverty reduction strategy papers university program in Honduras. So that's worth noting as well. I'll just say a couple more things and wrap up on this. Canada has also been engaged in a geopolitical, what I would call a geopolitical strategy with respect to the Andes, the Andean geopolitical strategy. I talked about it cozying up to Colombia as a way of isolating, or trying to isolate anyways, with uneven success, countries like Ecuador and Peru. And so what you've, if you sort of follow the things of foreign affairs and Minister Kent, who's no longer for the Minister for the Americas, but they would talk about this at the closing of democratic space in Venezuela. They would be publicly critical of Chavez while playing down the human rights problems, which are far greater in Colombia than Venezuela, obviously, in Colombia. And tied to this is a orientation now towards what's called democracy promotion, and we could talk about that a little bit more. It's more extensively developed in the United States. But Canada has been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, in various ways in funding through democracy promotion or human rights promotion, civil society organizations in Venezuela and in a number of other countries, particularly in the Andes, who are ideologically on side with Canada. And so in Venezuela, we know up until 2005, Canada had funded at least two, possibly more, organizations that had been in favor of or helped to supported the coup against Chavez. Subsequent to 2005, we're not exactly clear on how much has been spent on this because the information is actually redacted. Canada won't publicly release that information, claiming that it would threaten the security of individuals in Venezuela if they did so. But the Tories have tried to concentrate this program, and their plan is to take it, because right now funding comes from CEDA, comes from Foreign Affairs. The Tories want to take all that from CEDA, concentrate it in Foreign Affairs, and establish a new democracy promotion center that will actually start funding political parties in the third world, and particularly the orientation is towards Latin America and specifically in the Andes. And of course, I mentioned the coups as a key strategy. Again, we can talk about that a bit more. And my last point I'll just wrap up on is military and security policy. We know that Canada is planning on spending upwards of $50 billion, or increasing their spending by $50 billion over the next two decades on military procurement, increased number of military personnel and technology. And the policy documents going back to the 1990s are very clear that Canada faces a more uncertainty and insecurity in the world than they did during the Cold War, which is quite interesting how they sort of see the threats post-Cold War actually more dangerous than the Cold War. And the hotspots that they talk about are all emanate from the third world. Right? They're all in the third world. That's what gets highlighted. And they talk about the need to develop a more technologically sophisticated, flexible, and rapidly deployable military that can quickly get to these various hotspots to put out fires in the third world. And, of course, they've used Afghanistan as a strategy to increase that funding. But what's important to note, and I'll just wrap up on this, is that the majority of technology that's going to be procured by the Canadian military is going to actually be procured after Canada has either drawn down completely or significantly from Afghanistan. So D&D, Foreign Affairs, intellectuals behind the Tories and the Liberals, because the Liberals actually started on the Liberals. It was taken up with more gusto, actually the Liberals and the NDP in a minority coalition, brief minority coalition, but taken up with gusto by the Tories. They're actually thinking longer term. They're not thinking short term about this. Right? They're not thinking just about Afghanistan. They're thinking down the road. And what we need to be clear on here, going back to my point to start off, this isn't because the Americans want us to do it. It's not because we hold the bully's coat, as McQuaig might say. It's because Canada and the Canadian ruling class has objective material interests in the third world. It has interests just like other major powers do, and has vested interests in defending those interests in specific and the interests of global capitalism in general. And that's why we're seeing these foreign policy and security policy developments that we are. Thank you.